Zach, thank you for sitting down with me, man.
Glad to be with you. It's always good to be together and contemplating the fabric of the universe.
Yep. So this is my first episode that I'm recording coming off of the birth of my third child, which happened 2 weeks ago yesterday. And I mean, what an incredible gift that was to witness that. We had a home birth, and it's cool because my first child was born in a hospital system, so I got to experience that. Second one born in a birthing center, more natural birthing center, third one born at home. And what was beautiful about this whole birth was that my wife and I weren't trying at all. There was no indication that she was going to be pregnant. And my son walks up to my wife and says, "Mom, you're pregnant." 4 days before what would have been her period.
No,
my then six-year-old, kidding. Now seven-year-old son walks up to her and says that, "Mom, you're pregnant," very matter-of-factly. And we're like, "What?" He's like, "You're pregnant." We're like, "How do you know that?" And he's like, "I just know." And he walks away. And even now when you ask him that, he's like, "I don't know, I just knew." But around 6 months in, we randomly settled on this name Shai, S-H-A-I. And we didn't know where it came from. My wife said, "I feel like an S name is the right." And then we found Shai and we're like, "Oh, that's incredible." And then come to find out, that means gift in Hebrew. Then the whole birthing experience, I'll leave that for another time, but the home birth, he was born in call. So in the amniotic sac. So we literally had to unwrap him like a gift from God. And his name was Shai, which we had chosen a few months prior.
That is a trip and a half because
right?
My son, home birth, born in the call.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very interesting. That's a pretty unusual scenario. You're actually the first person I met that's had that shared experience. It was very bizarre when they're born in that water balloon and splitting those membranes and everything and watching them peel out of there is an amazing miracle.
It's incredible. I wonder, statistically speaking, like how many home births or births in a more natural, non-medical emergency-ized setting would end up in call like that. It seems just more of a gentle process of delivery, you know?
Very gentle process, yeah. Much different experience for the fetus, for sure. And, I've seen a lot. That was where my career started, was in midwifery out in the Philippines, working with a group of midwives out there. And I never saw it. So it may happen with increased frequency. I haven't seen those statistics suggest that, but it is such a miracle when it happens. It's spectacular. But it certainly, as we go into the hospital setting and more of the pathology treatment of pregnancy these days, that happens in the hospital setting often would certainly decrease the likelihood of it, in the sense that when you've got Pitocin and other drugs that are changing the intensity of the contractions and everything else, it would probably make it more difficult for that to occur.
Yeah. And that's actually where I wanted to start with you too, is your time in midwifery. And then you have, I think you're uniquely positioned in that you've been right there experiencing birth and also right there with a variety of people experiencing their final moments in life and seeing as they pass. So just want to have you talk on that.
Yeah, it was a neat career path, and that you start at one bookend and then you end up in the other bookend of life. But my first subspecialty was internal medicine, so I did a lot of hospital care, and some of my favorite stuff ended up being in the ICU setting and doing a lot of, you know, end of life experiences there. And in the ICU setting, you're equipped with a lot of tools and resources to try to restart hearts and everything else. And even the best case scenario where you're in the ICU, you got all the tools available and somebody's heart stops from whatever pathology, the chance of getting them back is 6%. So like, it's very difficult to change the exit strategy of a human, is what I have found over the years. Mm-hmm. And what I have come to conclude is you just simply can't. You can't change the moment of death, just as I don't think you can change the moment of conception or birth. You know, these are almost preconceived notions of coming in and out of the body. And I think these are events that occur cosmically before biologically, if that makes sense. I think there's the Kabbalah, which is the oldest science on the earth. The Kabbalah understands that there is no free will in nature, let alone humans, because there's so many billions of inputs into every single occurrence. And so it's impossible that one entity within that interconnected quantum entangled reality that we would call a universe could suddenly have free will and change its course. And so a change of course is a collaboration of, billions of inputs that would have something, shift. And so in that way, you can imagine, since time is a construct of the four-dimensional reality, that not necessarily, controls, it certainly doesn't control the quantum physics that's in the fabric of everything. And so there's no way that, some intervention in medicine is actually going to change the course of the life. And so the life was planned. The contract, if you will, was set in the matrix of the universe for entry and exit for something like a human life. And that takes a lot of pressure off all of us, I think, in some ways. And then the Kabbalah says something absolutely beautiful, which is, well, humans don't have any free will as to where they're going, what they're doing. They have infinite free will as to how they're going to experience it.
So we will be going, but how the going happens is where we have variation.
Absolutely. What's your experience of what's going to happen? What are you going to learn from it? What are you going to take away? What are you going to add to the vibration of the universe in that experience? And so are you going to go through in a pattern of programmed fear, guilt, and shame? Or are you going to find sovereignty and this unity pattern that comes from sovereignty that plays out in natural law? Are you going to be able to conjoin with the universe in a state that increases its vibration, or a state that, keeps it in a lower state of vibration and frequencies? And so that's a beautiful promise in a lot of ways. And I think it takes a lot of pressure off, or maybe pops the balloon of this whole attitude that's come into our kind of neo-spiritualism in the recent decades. I think it's been very strongly infused into this awakening that women have been going through in the last decades. And it got played in the 1990s through a couple books, but it was like, so suddenly every woman had to have an intention board and, put it in so that she could manifest her reality. And the downside of that process that I've seen in my own life is that if I sat down with an intention board and start drawing things, I'm going to be limited to my own human imagination. And I'm sitting there putting stuff down, telling the universe something rather than listening to the future that's already there. And so this is the shift that I think we could all make and take a lot of pressure off us and ultimately kind of exit out of the narcissism of, I'm going to manifest my future and I'm going to do the thing. And if I'm manifesting my future and you're not manifesting yours, I must be spiritually more enlightened than you are. And because yesterday I wrote on my board this and today it appeared. And so I must be a higher priestess than you. Like, I've heard this stuff for decades now. And I watch it play out in my own life of like, when do I give up the narcissism that I'm in control of anything? And when do I get into the childlike joy of I am the recipient of everything? I am receiving and receiving and receiving and receiving the future that's already there. And it's coming to me. It's not something I should chase, And when I change my attitude from the chase to the receiving, it fundamentally changes everything in my biology. And there's all this biohacking going on in the world and everything else, which we should have been cued off by the term biohacking, probably, that we were probably going down the wrong path. But when you stop trying to hack the universe and start to receive from the universe, it changes your neurologic system, changes your immune system, changes your overall psychology, shifts your philosophy. The amount of stillness that we're capable of stepping into is infinite. And when you start to move towards that stillness, my goodness, does miracle appear everywhere. And it's a miracle on the level that you and your wife just experienced. There's no human that can plan out an event like a soul quantum entangling with a human cell that we would call an ovum. And that one egg with 500,000 mitochondria releasing a bolt of lightning at the moment of conception. That bolt of lightning is enough discharge from the physics side of that equation to quantum entangle a soul at that moment. that's, there's no human that can participate in that process. And so all we can really do is create spaces within our bodies that we fully turn over to God. And what I would, if the word God doesn't resonate, it's basically the still point in the universe that witnesses everything so that it can become particle. There is a still point in the universe that witnessed the sacred geometry within the perfect chaos of fuzzy space. And the moment you witness sacred geometry and the macro patterns of the universe, you can see that, you know, 64 double tetrahedron, because you are still, you witness the pattern in space, and immediately it has to turn into particle. And so the first universe is born when a still point in this, in space time, can suddenly witness the bigger macro patterns, and suddenly the first universe is there. Within a universe, there's a single point in the center that then witnesses everything within itself, and it starts seeing the patterns within that potential space. The womb of a woman is the only place that we have biologically where the woman is able to completely blind herself to the patterns of nature within it. She uses progesterone to completely block her capacity to see what's happening in there. It is a God space in the sense that that is the universe held in a human body, surrendered to the universe itself, such that something that no human could participate in is going to happen there. And so to get there, you have to get everything in the human story out of the way, because the human story is a long, deeply entrenched belief that we got kicked out of nature. Well, if nature's going to do her most magnificent thing and create through you, you are going to have to blind yourself in that space to the story. You're going to have to create such stillness and such vulnerability there, such surrender ultimately to the possibilities. And when the surrender is there, then the magnificence can come through. And so it turns out that each of us have a space within our core that's been long talked about in the Danxian, the center of things in Chinese philosophy and Chinese medicine, and all of this is long pointed to the Danxian. So if you do Tai Chi or Qigong, constantly your focus is bringing you, those practices or mudras or body positions to help you lose the sense of separateness and come into that singularity of surrender at that core space and get that silence activated. And then the creativity of the human becomes unparalleled. You know?
Man, that's exactly what it felt like in that birthing experience too, because my wife and I were talking just the other day that, you know, we did a home birth and we were inside our house, but it was such a portal, for lack of a better term, that it didn't feel like that setting, that time during the birthing experience was actually inside of our house. It was another reality, another aspect of reality morphed into this one that was so incredibly surreal. But even laying in our bedroom, which is where the birth happened, like each day now since the birth, reflecting back on that experience, it's like that doesn't even seem like it was the same place. It really felt like a sort of godlike presence was so ingrained into that situation, so fundamentally an aspect of it. Not that God isn't always a part of this experience, but like it was so palpable there in the birthing process that it literally felt like we were in a completely different place.
I agree with that. I think that I've seen that happen almost everywhere I've seen a birth, you know, and I've birthed babies on the dirt floors of tin shacks and monsoon rains outside of Quezon City and the Philippines and all kinds of spaces that you wouldn't think appropriate to be birthing babies. And those were the healthiest kids I ever saw born in so many ways. You know, they were just part of nature. Nature was there. There was one birth in particular, just downpouring and so much lightning in the air. And so 4-pound baby comes out of this tiny little woman in the Philippines there. And there's no sense of poverty. There's no sense of scarcity. There's no sense of anything but miraculous connectivity to the universe. You feel so much abundance in that moment. And that woman stood up after birthing that baby and went into the other room and prepared tea for all of us. You know, like she didn't see any hardship in the process. She didn't know that it was even miraculous. You know, she was birthing her 7th kid. And it was more a sense of, I turn this over to God. God does its thing, and would you like to drink some tea? So, you can imagine how shocked he was when I saw my first American Bros. Like, it was the polar
opposite. You saw those first, right?
Yeah, I saw those first. Oh, man. I had never even been in a hospital when I was out there.
What was that like?
Which side? The hospital side?
The hospital side, yeah. After having seen birth in its natural state, like the entire concept of a medical emergency, like birth being a medical emergency, yeah, and all the interventions, the epidurals, the Pitocin, the unnecessary mm-hmm. ultrasounds, the non-emergency C-sections, all of them, all the yeah, things, the shots, like shocking. All of it. Yeah.
I mean, in my case, it was pure shock. The universe just lined it up so well. In hindsight, I guess I was just being prepared for my future, you know, 17 years in academic medicine, and then my ultimate, you know, divorce from that system in so many ways. But my first birth that I witnessed in the United States was, I had put my OBGYN as my very first clinical rotation in medical school, because I was like, I'm going to just ace this thing, and obviously it'll be the best. And that was so exciting to kind of sense. It was the first time in medical school where I was like, I felt like I had a leg up, because I went to the Philippines planning to be an engineer, and then came back from that experience realizing I wanted to go to medicine. But I had never been that good of a student. So most of pre-med, as well as, you know, the 4 years of pre-med, then med school, were, you know, 8 years of me trying to catch up with my colleagues that were all acing everything all the time. And so I thought, okay, that OBGYN month is going to be when it just nails it and I get to be head of the class for a moment. And, so I was in my white coat and stethoscope and looking all doctor-like for the first time and first day of my medical rotations, and my pager goes off. Well, that actually dates me right there. Probably a pager was the thing that went on your belt and vibrated because we didn't have cell phones at the time. But when the pager went off, I looked down, and they would always page us the room number, the ER room number. And so I go just charging down the stairs, determined to beat all of the residents and the fellows and whoever else might show up. And I charge in, and this African-American woman is actively coding on the table. Her heart had stopped a couple of seconds before I came in the room. And so they're paddling her with the electric paddles, and there's just chaos in the room. And she's hemorrhaging. She's about 5 months, 6 months pregnant. And so they're actively coding her. The chief in the ER is screaming to get some epinephrine, lidocaine into her bloodstream. And her sister or somebody from the family is basically yelling over the chaos, trying to get us information, because she had just been rolled into the ER actively dying. And her sister was trying to communicate that she had just overdosed on cocaine. And so the rush was to get that baby out of mom, if we could save the baby. And so the fellows and residents come crashing in a couple seconds later, and then they've got me like on the back of the gurney. Like, they had me on the table, the gurney itself, and they're pushing it down the thing, and they're telling me to get vitals and all this stuff. So I'm trying to keep track of what's going on. And this woman, her heart was running at that time. She's unconscious and crashed into an emergency C-section setting in the operating room. And that was pretty ridiculous to watch, because, you know, the fellows from skin, you cut the skin, you cut the abdominal wall, which is a thick layer of muscle, and then you get to the uterus, and you push aside whatever's left of the intestine. The uterus is right there. It's a thick wall of muscle, cut through the muscle, and then you got the amniotic sac, and then you got baby. And it was 32 seconds from skin to baby as they did the crash C-section. And pull this baby out, as blue at first, pinks up quick with its first breath. They cut the umbilical cord, and mom dies on the table about 2 minutes later. And that child then goes into severe cocaine withdrawal over the next 2 days and dies of complications of cocaine withdrawal. And so that was my first experience in the United States. And in some ways, it was a foreshadowing of the next 17 years of my career, which was looking deeper, deeper, and deeper into this wound of humanity that is ultimately caused by a deep division or divorce from nature. Mm-hmm. And it's that nature deficit disorder that puts us into the state that I watched in that woman, because it turns out that abandonment disorder is the foundation of all addiction. And when humanity walks around with a unified storytelling of our abandonment from nature, we got kicked out of the garden, that deep-seated belief that we're trying to get back to God, get back to nature, and we're not part of it, you know, is really sets us up for addiction. And so that plays out in a million different ways, including a mother that doesn't have support from a socioeconomic system, that doesn't see any value in motherhood, doesn't see any value in its future children, and so doesn't see anything wrong with an economy that poisons its food system in the name of production and productivity. And for that, we end up with the birth that I witnessed. And so you compare that to the Philippines, where they have no money. They're birthing their babies on mud floors and tin shacks, with health and with a state of vibrancy in both mother and child, and they have seven kids, and you can't really put a more exacting contrast on the indigenous understanding that we are of Earth, we are from Earth, and it is birthing through us, to we are divorced from Earth, it's against us, we need to, you know, assuage our pain and suffering with addiction, and we will pathologize everything, including this miracle birth.
And it's, correct me if I'm wrong on this, like it's just the belief that we're separate from nature is what needs to be examined ultimately, and derived from that, it's, well, separateness from God, and God is a fundamental aspect as nature is, from the way that I see it at the least. And then from that is derived fear, guilt, and shame. How do we correct this fear, guilt, and shame that we're swimming in as mankind? Because I mean, that's something that I've struggled with in my life quite a bit, from various, you know, traumatic childhood experiences. And I think I've done a good job, you know, reconfiguring that and questioning those foundational beliefs about myself, but it's still something that's run rampant in the background in my mind in many ways. And I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah. I think you're on the journey that we're all on, which is, how do you reprogram a biologic belief system, you know, because it's not a mental belief system, it's biologic, it's programmed into the cellular structures at this point. And so whenever you put a stress on an organism, it changes the methylation patterns on top of the DNA, and we call that an epigenetic change. And so the epigenetics don't change the genes, they're the same, but the behavior of the gene changes. And so when you stress an organism, it has a very predictable fingerprint of methylation. And so a chemical stress from an herbicide, or, you know, a nuclear injury at the DNA level, whatever it is, or a psychosocial stressor that might be you've been abandoned, you know, and as soon as that's in there, you have this predictable fingerprint of stress that then changes the 20,000 genes that we claim to be human. And the 20,000 genes are a very small number. You know, we have to come to terms with how simple we are biologically. And it's still a mystery as to why this is. I have no idea why we have so few genes. It doesn't make any sense in regards to the bigger understanding of what DNA is. I think we've been very slow to accept that we don't understand DNA, and we were handed the wrong framework from Watson and Crick and the rest. And so it's really looks more like the DNA is an antenna system held within this cell that's picking up a quantum physics signaling from what we might call a soul. So there's some organized electromagnetic field that is you, that has an identity before it becomes human and after it becomes human, and that identity seems to be unchanging. And you can experience this in my last sub, especially after internal medicine. That was endocrinology, and endocrinology, I was studying water structure and metabolism of the mitochondria. And when you start to study mitochondria, you realize, oh my gosh, there is no such thing as human. There's only an ecosystem that expresses itself as human. There is no human species, because without a massive, massive ecosystem within us, we have no life, let alone intelligence or whatnot. So that was my second. And then third was getting into the hospice palliative care. And that was 4 years of admitting 80 patients a week to die. And so when you see that much death on the tail end of seeing, you know, life back in the day, you come to terms with the fact that these identities are permanent. You're watching people dip in and out of the veil. When my son looked at me through the veil of that water balloon of the membranes when he was born, he has these huge brown eyes that he got from his mom, and just amazing to see a child staring at you from the other side, has never felt human air, has never breathed a breath, and is so conscious. And that thing is staring at you, and it is so aware of its environment and its being, and it's staring at you with a bit of awe in its face of like, how is that thing, you know, surviving? Because I think he could see, I felt intensely that my son could see that I was separate from something, you know, that I had lost some sort of connection. And he has patiently, you know, over his almost 30 years now, he's been patiently waiting for me to reconnect. I think, you know, he's just a genius level mind, and he came in knowing too much stuff. Like, you know, it was like, that's not fair, A. But B, that's not coming from your human brain. Like, he was remembering things and didn't seem to have to forget in the same way I had to forget everything. And so it could be that, you know, the lawyers changed in the cosmos. He no longer had to sign the amnesia agreement to be human. Something with this recent generation coming in, because the kids are coming in remembering stuff and knowing stuff, you know.
Oh my god. Yeah. I mean, some of the things that my 7-year-old son has said, like, luckily I have the wherewithal to ask more leading questions rather than shut it down. It's like, oh, that sounds cute, that's funny. Right. It's like, no, tell me more. Like, that, I'm conditioned, I want to learn. Yeah, I know,
please get me back.
Yeah, exactly. It's incredible. And I've shared this on a number of episodes, and we will have a demonstration this year at Confluence, which will be incredible. There will be, at least counting on top of my head, 9 kids there who have been activated to read blindfolded.
And oh, cool. Those are amazing.
Have you seen that in person before?
Yeah, for sure.
It is incredible when you witness it in person. And my son will be taking a class taught by a friend of mine, Dr. Edith Amutu-Chan, here soon. And a few of my other friends, their kids have already gone through her class and they've been activated. And one of my friend's daughters is like remote viewing into other rooms with like almost near 100% accuracy. It's really incredible. Like, yeah. I think this is a fundamental aspect of who we are. And this is us going through a remembering process of who and what we truly are.
That's exactly the game. That's the one we've been fighting through. And it's not new that, like, there's part of me that's like, oh my gosh, this is new that we've got this generation coming in. But there's always been access points to the multidimensional thing. Every generation, you know, every generation's got its gifted people. And I'm hopeful that this will just simply be the first time that we just don't go kill all those people, you know, because that has been our pattern. Anytime we do a witch hunt, or we call it something, and, you know, we hunt these people down because we're intimidated by what we can't see. And that has not gone well in the past. And I do see that shift happening. The fact that parents are sending their kids to schools to do that, you know. Yeah. 200 years ago in this country, those kids would have been hidden from reality so they wouldn't be killed, you know?
Right.
Because the parents were very afraid when their children had, appropriately afraid when their kids had multidimensional skills. And so it's been suppressed for eons, probably, but certainly for the last couple thousand years, that's been something that has been hunted down. And to see a society that's starting to embrace that and starting to train that again into our children, which is really to say, allow them to do what they already know how to do, just to empower them with our belief that they can do it, is all that's really necessary. And that's really hopeful. I feel optimistic about our time, even though I now feel agnostic as to whether or not we're going to biologically recover from this extinction event we're in. And the reason it has to do with that epigenetics that I mentioned. So we only have 20,000 genes. That's, you know, 13,000 genes in a fruit fly, 30,000 genes in a flea. So you sit somewhere between a fruit fly and a flea. And that a flea has, you know, 30% more genes than you do is pretty mysterious. We don't, again, entirely understand that. But the ramifications are really interesting, that it may suggest that humans are uniquely equipped to have the most plastic genome. And so our genes can make more decisions and have more protein outputs than any other species. So somehow we're making more proteins from a very limited genome than maybe any other species on the planet. And so we're utilizing our genetic information at a very high order of flexibility. And so we've been the most flexible of biologies on the planet so far. And that seems to have a direct correlation with the amount of biodiversity that our organism holds. My body is, if I was living in an ideal state where I wasn't poisoning my body every day, every time I drank water or had a bite of food with antibiotics, which is our herbicide, pesticides, and all of our other residues in our food water system. So if you put me back in a hunter-gatherer system in North America or Africa, today we study the African tribes that are still in that this kind of indigenous culture of hunting and gathering, and a typical gut over there will have 40,000 species of bacteria. The fungi we haven't even categorized well, but you might be out in 500,000 different species of fungi, yeast, protozoa, parasites, the whole thing. And none of those are bad things. Like humans hear parasites these days and we kind of freak out. Those are completely normal and important parts of a balanced ecosystem.
All of those things.
All of those things. And so people are right now, because of the unfortunate penetration of the programming of functional medicine, we're now terrified of molds. And you know, so I've got a lot of people that are running around like, you know, I think my home has mold in it and all this. I'm not trying to diminish the fact that our homes can be very toxic places, but it's not the mold that's the problem. It's the fact that you have a house that was divorced from nature, and therefore the mold is trying to get it back to nature. And so,
can I share something real quick on that same point? I've often brought up this. I have a few friends who've done what's called forest bathing in order to reverse various cancers. That's what they claim, right? I'm not making that claim on their part, nor is this medical advice in any way. But how is it that those individuals will be exposed to the same types of black mold while they're forest bathing in Washington state and resolve cancer? But then when we're inside a building, we're referring to those same types of mold as toxic and disease causing. And that's what I always point people towards. The mold is there to bioremediate the materials that are toxic. And an unfortunate byproduct of that is that those toxic building materials are being leached into the environment, but it's not the mold that is the problem. It's the toxic building materials that are the problem.
You're exactly right. You are precisely right. And even the CDC knows this, but never tells us. So anytime there's an infectious disease outbreak, the Centers of Disease Control don't just send the viral experts and everything else. They send the poison experts. And every time. But really? They have never disclosed the findings of the poison team. And I know 100% my DNA that every time we've had a quote unquote infectious disease where nature is attacking us with a new virus or a new this, it's always because there's been there's been an environmental toxin introduced and there is biologic remediation going on. And this goes to the most common things you think, you know, Western medicine has figured out. HIV is a good example of it. And, you know, every single article on HIV starts with, you know, HIV is the virus that causes AIDS. You can go Google that, and like HIV and AIDS articles, science articles, and you will notice that that is the only sentence in the entire, you know, peer-reviewed science journal that has no reference on it. Because there is no scientific experiment that's proved that HIV causes AIDS. And Luc Montagnier, who is the guy who isolated HIV as a virus for the first time and got the Nobel Prize for HIV, he became a friend towards the end of his life, and he passed away during COVID. And the reason he reached out was because he had, you know, developed an herbal compound for reversing the COVID syndrome. And he, you know, way earlier than the end of his life, like very, you know, decades before he passed, he was trying to reverse the belief that HIV was causing AIDS. Like it was very clear that that hadn't played out in science. But at that point, he and his science had been so owned by the political and economic machine of Western medicine that it just couldn't be reversed. But so we have all these dyed-in-the-wool beliefs about these things. Actually, another great example that just plays into what you were saying is Lyme disease. When I went through all my medical stuff in the 1990s, nobody was talking about Lyme disease anywhere. Like, it was a rare condition. It was a very well-known belt that happened between, you know, kind of Maryland down to Tennessee was where kind of the Lyme tick belt was. And suddenly, while I'm well into my medical career, 2003, 2006, suddenly you just can't get away from the word Lyme and Lyme disease and chronic Lyme. By 2010, 2012, it's a billion-dollar industry of supplements and detox programs, and we're selling literally billions of dollars of cash out of pocket for consumers that have now been told they have Lyme disease. And I was so frightened by this syndrome because I watched my colleagues. It's the strangest thing how the brain rationalizes things when it has to do with money. Like, it's really phenomenal. And it's actually probably goes beyond money.
It's not malicious either.
It's not malicious at all. And the man, mine, maybe it's not even the money that rationalizes it. It's the belief that I'm the one that's going to save you.
Yeah.
We so want to be the savior. We so want to fix something so that we have value. And so maybe the value is then reflected in the money we charge, but we so want to believe that we're the one that's going to figure it out and save someone, that we can rationalize anything. And so I watched an entire medical industry see people coming in with chronic inflammation and chronic fatigue and say, you must have Lyme disease, run the Lyme test. They all come back negative and they say, well, the test sucks. And this isn't, that must, it's actually a conspiracy that the test doesn't even read your thing and all this. And so I'm going to use this other tool and I'm going to diagnose it sideways. And then I'm going to, you know what? The tests are still negative, so I'm just going to treat you for Lyme because you will definitely get better. And then
you start intravenous antibiotics.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you're on IV antibiotics and you're on $13,000 of supplements for a 6-month program. And within weeks, the patient starts rigoring every time they get an antibiotic. Like, their whole body looks like they're going into sepsis. And the doctor says, well, this is really good news. This means you're detoxing. This is an hermetic thing. What's happening is they're getting their body poisoned by the antibiotic, killing the microbes that are trying to bioremediate, as you say. So anyway, I'm watching that whole thing happen. And so I started giving lectures by 2012 on what is a spirochete. And the spirochete is a very well-established family of bacteria that live in our mouth, in our whole GI tract all the time. And if you lose your spirochetes in your mouth, you can't detox the body. And if you play that out, then if your body does get poisoned, those spirochetes need to move from your mouth and your gut into the body tissue to detox the tissue that's now been poisoned. And the reason why spirochetes are so important is they are the only organism in there that uses non-carbon based molecules for energy.
Wow.
And so bacteria, fungi, and humans, we all use carbohydrates and fats. Both, all those are carbon-based substrates. The spirochetes are chemoheterotrophs, which means that they can actually break apart sulfur compounds and get energy out of them. Turns out sulfur compounds are the dominant feature in a lot of the herbicides, pesticides, and other things. We end up getting sulfur poisoning. And so by 2012, I'm teaching spirochetes, and it dawns on me, like, I need to overlap this map with the pesticide herbicides. And sure enough, 1976 comes along. We start pouring all these herbicides, pesticides into the Midwest. All of that ends up the River Valley. I'd already shown this pattern with cancer and was lecturing on that already. But when I saw the spirochete map, I just burst out laughing. Like, it's a perfect overlay of how the syndrome moved from Maryland to Tennessee, all of a sudden to Ohio, Colorado, Midwest. And like, we just inundated the whole country with this syndrome of chronic fatigue, chronic thing, because we were poisoning people with sulfur, at which point the spirochete was the only organism that was going to come to your aid. And so then you end up testing the person to say, you've got a spirochete. We got to kill the spirochete.
It's a classic example of the analogy that I oftentimes use of blaming the firefighter for being present at the site of the fire. It is there doing the role that is designed to do. Yeah, it's exactly. Proliferating in an attempt to put the fire out. It is not causing the fire.
That's right. And I mean, it gets more ridiculous than that. Once they give you all the antibiotics, you don't feel any better. In fact, you feel worse, all this. And then my colleagues developed all these tests to check for rickettsia and these other, you know, tick-borne organisms. So they'd say, oh, you must not have Lyme, but you have rickettsia. So we're going to switch your algorithm. We're going to kill the rickettsia. After 2 years of that going around, all these, you know, functional medicine lectures of like, oh, it's the rickettsia and here's the protocol and here's the... So now hundreds of doctors running around treating tens of thousands of people with rickettsial illness, and that doesn't work, and all the patients are still, you know, dragging and all this, and you, of course, a few patients, you know, bioremediate themselves out of the situation somehow or some way, and we then claim that we had a victory or whatever, and then suddenly, the next, like, 2 years later, and this is when I suddenly was like, I gotta get myself out of this circuit, like, because it came in then of like, oh, it's the retroviruses that are in the tick.
And oh, so my it's God,
not,
I know.
Not the bacteria. It's the retroviruses of the tick that are causing you. So we need to put you on antivirals. So just with that one issue of young women and men being poisoned with their food system, and then we blame it on the microbiome, now we've damned three types of bacteria, 40 retroviruses. We're poisoning the person into oblivion, trying to sterilize their body. When we've known for 30 years now that the only healthy human body is a complex ecosystem that's there to remediate balance. And so any course of antibiotics, antifungals, antivirals is going to end up being a disaster on restoring this balance. And so in this extraordinary way, you've got that side. And then you've got the supplement industry saying, well, we got to give you probiotics. We got to give you probiotics. We got to give you probiotics. And so all these companies have made, right now it's like $47 billion a year are spent on some form of antibiotics globally. $47 billion, okay?
Wow.
And what's the science on that? Again, find me an article that says taking this probiotic actually improves the outcome. And they finally did the definitive studies in 2018 to look at what actually happens to the gut microbiome and where do those probiotic organisms end up living in the gut if you take these things, especially after antibiotic exposure. And so they did this incredible study in mice, and it was so profound that three other groups repeated in humans. And so most of those studies were published in the journal Cell, which is one of our most rigorous peer-reviewed studies out there. And they were able to demonstrate that, you know, 2 weeks of antibiotics drops your biodiversity by about 80%. And then they randomized both the mice and then the humans to fecal transplant, which was encapsulated stool from before they had the antibiotic. So they're taking their own microbiome back orally, or to placebo or to probiotic. And these were three species probiotics with billions of copies, a very typical, the most typical one that's on the market. And so with the probiotic, they showed there was initial effort towards recovery for the first 3 to 5 days of the microbiome's recovery after an antibiotic, but with the continued use of the probiotic, a suppression right back down to the same level of the antibiotic suppression occurs, and then the microbiome slowly starts to try to trickle back towards biodiversity over the next 6 months, but even at 6 months, you're at 40% of where you were before the antibiotic exposure. In the fecal transplant, they, not surprisingly, bounce back to their normal flora within like 3.5 weeks. With placebo, they completely recovered in 4 weeks.
Whoa.
And so if you can take a sugar pill and bounce your microbiome back in 4 weeks versus your probiotic keeps you suppressed for 6 months, and then, you know, more frightening than that, they showed that these organisms, contrary to what the whole probiotic industry said, which is, don't worry, these organisms just pass through your gut. They're not actually setting up a monoculture, which is, of course, the appropriate concern. You take billions of copies of three species when you're supposed to have a balance of 40,000 species. You're doing something there that's concerning. But they always insisted that they can't set up in the human gut flora. They just pass through to do some sort of magic. And they always kind of wave their hands as to like what exactly is happening. If it's not staying in the gut, if it's not creating a flora shift, then what is it doing? But at any rate, one of the rationales as to why it wasn't dangerous to take these probiotic species that everybody's taking at $47 billion a year is because they're derived from cow guts. And so since it's not normal to a human gut, but it's a ruminant, you know, flora that we're giving you, it can't actually set up shop in your acidified human gut. So we probably should have asked then, like, well, why are we taking cow flora if that's it? And so right now there's only one probiotic in the market. There's a three species probiotic that comes out of Australia that actually was derived from human flora. I still have the same concerns, everything else. But the fact is, we've got thousands of brands on the market that are all derived from cow gut. And unfortunately, the studies in 2018 proved out that those bacteria are setting up monoculture in the lining of the gut. And it's very difficult then to get those back out. It's difficult to regain balance. And that's why that long-term probiotic use was suppressing the microbiome recovery to near the level of antibiotic use. At any rate, whether we're demonizing the microflora or we're trying to micromanage the microflora, we're going to continue to fall short of the promise that you are of nature. Nature is you. You can't divorce yourself from nature unless you use these warlike tactics where you demonize and kill, demonize and kill. And that has played out so deeply in our psyche now that if you look up the word nature in the Oxford English Dictionary, it says it's everything in the firmament of the earth. It is the minerals, it's the plants, it's the animals, as opposed to humans or anything humans have made.
Opposed.
Not just separate, opposition.
So humans came up with a definition of nature that puts us in opposition to everything else in the natural world.
And I love it that it includes anything that we've made.
And anything that we've made.
Yeah. Which I'm sitting there like I built my own house out of trees that I made that house.
Yeah.
I built a lot of furniture. I'm pretty sure that oak table that I built is very much part of nature still. Like
my beautiful energy coming off of it, right?
Plane that wood and maybe sanded it a bit and stained it a bit, but that's a tree.
That's a tree.
I made that thing. There's just no way that definition is right.
Wow, that's wild, though. That is wild that that's the definition. Oh my goodness. I have a couple friends who are like very well trained in dark field microscopy, and they say that they have seen repeatedly bacteria or fungi morph into another type of bacteria fungi in isolated conditions just by changing the external environment a bit, which is a concept of what Bichamp called microzyma pleomorphism, expanding on top of that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I love those guys, Koch and Bichamp and all those guys. We're hard at it. I think it was Koch who did it, but both Koch and Bichamp were arguing back in the day that
it was Bichamp and Pasteur. Pasteur was arguing with Bichamp.
Koch was on Bichamp's side. So Koch and Bichamp were both arguing that it was an ecosystem. Pasteur was arguing that it was a germ theory kind of thing and we were being attacked. But I think it was Koch that ended up pulling off. He was debating on stage with Pasteur, and Pasteur had brought a glass that was colonated with cholera, and he was making this big argument for proving that he could prevent cholera by this. And Koch is insisting on stage, showing a bunch of public health data, that it's not the cholera that's causing the problem, it's the toxicity of the inner city environments that's killing the microbiome people, and then the cholera becomes poisonous, because he wasn't finding the same cholera outbreaks just a few miles outside the cities where the water seemed to carry a very similar amount of cholera. And so he gets finally hits this fervor of passion. He walks across the stage and grabs the glass of cholera and drinks it in front of the group, puts it down. And that's the kind of conviction that's missing, I think, in scientists today, right? Of I was guilty of this as well. As we do something under the microscope in a petri dish, and then we wave our hands and make some generalized conclusions from that, never actually proving out the theory. Mm-hmm. We never take it to the step of drinking the cholera.
Yeah.
And because we miss that step of applied science, we have so much half-truth baked into our scientific methodology. And that's scary.
Yeah.
We really actually don't know anything. We have a bunch of scientific postulates, I would say, or theories that have been put out there that are backed by a small amount of data that was all done in sterile petri dishes. And so when you have a sterile petri dish and you claim that you understand a natural system, you're missing the whole point of a natural system. The word biosis is interesting, and it kind of really points to this. Biosis is in reference to the relationships and their interconnectedness that makes life possible. Biotic is in reference to the biosis, so the synergy of relationships. Antibiotic, against the relationships that make life possible. And so when we started banking trillions of dollars of medical industry in the antibiotic effort to kill bacteria, fungi, viruses, cancer cells, whatever it is, that issue that I did wake up one day and realize I'm headed back to the hospital, and all that's running through my mind is, what do I need to kill today? Mm-hmm. I got that patient over there in that suite that's got invasive bacteria. I got that patient over there with cancer cells I need to kill. Like, I suddenly that aha moment of like, wait, what am I doing? Who am I?
Right.
Is this really what I entered this field to do? Like, where's those babies, and how did they come? This isn't right. There's something right. wrong. But it took me a long time, because the frog in boiling water, really, it doesn't notice. Like, I was a fully baked, fully boiled brain, and had lost the force for the trees completely. And I think of myself as a relatively intelligent person, and I'm just dumbfounded by the ease at which I was programmed with.
But we're all stuff, subject to it, though. That's the thing. It's like, we're all subject to that, not just so-called medical experts. All of us are. And that's where I think it's like, it would behoove of us not to question our identity necessarily. Like, that is fixed. Our true identity, who we truly are, is fixed, in my opinion. And, well, I won't say fixed, but it cannot be destroyed. Let's put it that way. But to question our foundational presuppositions on a variety of things, and that's totally healthy to do that, and to do that with childlike wonder and awe, saying, okay, I don't know that they have it figured out. They're claiming that it's this. I don't know that they have it figured out. What is it? I don't know, but I'm going to explore this with childlike wonder and awe to try to get a sense of what's going on in this realm. You know, I think that's what's missing from that whole paradigm. The reason that I brought up the concept of microzyma is, like, I really enjoy looking to nature as a reflection of, like, what might be happening. And recently, I noticed in our raised beds, because my wife and I are in the process of moving, so we didn't plant anything this time. In our raised beds, in each of the four raised beds that we have, there's completely different weeds growing in each of them. And last time we'd planted food, there's completely different foods in each of the raised beds, right? And it's almost like the potential for those specific weeds was always there in each of the beds. And depending on the unique needs of that soil, that certain type of weed proliferated in order to bring balance back to that soil. But the energy potential for all of them were always present inside there, which ties back to me, like, oh, the concept of microzyma and pleomorphism, that bacteria, fungi will pleomorph depending on the role of the terrain that they're presented with, and that type will proliferate, and then it'll come back to a somatid, or come back to a microzyma, whatever you want to call it, and then back to a bacterial form, back to a fungi form, and then back again. It just makes sense given what I've observed in nature, you know?
Yeah. You're spot on. I mean, it's a really good observation in your own garden, and we're seeing it play out in a billion acres in the U.S. and Canada. 1 billion acres of farmland are now growing highly resistant weeds to the multi-modality chemicals that are trying to kill those weeds. So just like you get an antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the ICU because of all the use of antibiotics, you use enough antibiotics on your crops, your crops are going to figure out a way out. They're going to escape. And the way that they do it is through that biodiversification. And so my favorite example of this is in the Midwest right now. There's six states that are now growing this weed that looks just apocalyptic. And
like, intentionally growing it?
No, it's come out of nature. So this organism has now spread across these fields as a weed, and it looks like kind of like about the size of a Christmas tree when it's in its full thing. It's big. Wow. And it's got a trunk. Like, it is a thick, fibrous trunk that once it goes into its full extent. And when it's full grown, to get full grown, it's only a matter of weeks, you know. And so even at relatively short levels before it pops its head up above the crop, it's got such a woody stem on it that it will destroy the machinery as it goes through the crop. So it will destroy a harvester and the blades and everything else. And it'll take out the sprayers. It's like, it's a potent disruptor to the mechanical mechanism. So,
and this is one that farmers hadn't typically seen before.
Right. And it's just cropped up, and it's demonstrating just how hard nature is overcoming this mechanical, this chemical insult of current industrial farming. It will come up with something deep in that seed bank of, like, what could combat this level of damage, this level of warfare. And so when you see these things, they're thorny. They've got these giant thorns, cuts your hands up if you go after them. But one of the very first farms that I filmed for Farmer's Footprint, which is our nonprofit that's working on accelerating the adoption of and understanding of regenerative organic gardening as a necessary thing in the backyards, as well as a necessary implementation to our global farming system. The first farm was up in Minnesota area, and they were suffering the problem of these weeds that I'm describing here, and they couldn't figure out an implement that was working. And so they had gotten down to the point where they had to go out and manually clear these things before they would put a machine into the fields. And so it would be 12 hours of hard labor of a couple of guys with, you know, small hand saws and gloved up the best they could. And they'd come back just bloodied up from wrestling these things out of the fields. And then they made the transition to regenerative organic, and they started diversifying the flora, and they stopped spraying, they stopped plowing, and they started, seed drilling instead of plowing up the soil. They just would drill down to each seed. They started planting 30 species cover crops, and within two seasons, there was not a single weed left on that thing that had that thing. And so they're not spraying anything. They're not, and the weeds are gone. Because the weeds were filling this very important niche. And it's pretty amazing to go walk their fields, because you literally go to their fence line, and 3 feet over the fence line to their neighbors is these wow. apocalyptic weeds growing. So it's wow. not like their land isn't seeing that weed. Right. All of those seeds are all over their land still. It's on around every fence line they have. And so there's no way their farm suddenly got rid of those seeds, right? Not right. got rid of that weed species. It's certainly there, but like you said, it's not needed now.
Yeah.
And so so the regenerative farmers are now really encouraged to let go of the word weed altogether, realizing there is no such thing. Nature has never created a noxious anything. She always creates something, a balance of something, and if it's out of balance, she'll create something to bring it back in balance. And so once we reach that concept, so instead of weeds, they call them forbs. And
what's that term mean?
Forbs is a bit of a created term, but it was a nice term in that it fits into the foraging kind of concept. And so the animals that forage are looking for the biodiversity. And so once you start to realize these aren't weeds, these are forbs. These are things that are trying to return nutrients, the nutrient cycle into things. So foraging is a process of nutrient cycling. So forbs is a description of what's the biodiversity that allows for nutrient cycling to kick back in, basically. And once you start to embrace those weeds and you start walking through your field, means I'm so grateful that you're here to teach me. I'm so grateful you're going to show me a path out of my current problem. And I have a lot of farmers around the world now that are treating their land that way, where everything they see in gratitude.
Wow.
And when you start projecting gratitude and love, you actually change the frequency of the plants. And we've seen this again and again in EEG studies and everything else. You change the growth factors, you change the way in which the roots are expressing themselves. It's really, really cool that the human is playing a role in the ecosystem. And our role seems to be, which frequency are we transmitting? And if we walk around in fear, guilt, and shame and warlike mentality of, you know, I'm going to kill you before you kill me kind of attitude in nature, it picks up that frequency. And it has no choice but to put up a defensive stance. Mm. You walk around in gratitude in a system of just awe of like, I don't even know what nature's doing here. It looks ridiculous right now. It looks like a complete chaotic system. It looks like doctors just told me I got cancer. I'm so fascinated by what that is. Like, those are just my cells. Those cancer cells are all me. What part of me am I rejecting? What part of me have I isolated? What part of me have I rejected and judged until the darkness is so deep that it can't find itself? Why is that cell so isolated that it becomes a cancer cell? And thank you, cancer. And again, a year and a half in my clinic, my patients again and again would tell me, and it was always visible on their face before they'd even say it, but they'd suddenly come in this like glowing state, and they would say, Doc, you know what? After this 5-year journey, I suddenly realized that my cancer was the best gift I've ever gotten in my life. And they would start crying and tell you everything that that cancer had taught them. And they will tell you what they're now loving about themselves that they had not been able to love before. And so whether it be the forbs in the field or the cancer cells in our bodies, when we start to see everything as our teacher, everything as our witness of an ascending process to self-awareness and wholeness that has to return to humanity if we're going to persist. And The nature's going to thrive. Nature always is thriving. Nature has no problem at all. And humans aren't a problem for nature. I don't see it that way at all. I think our cancerous behavior on this planet is just as powerful as the cancer in our bodies. If we come to accept that as the cancer in the body, we also are a gift, even in our malignant behavior that's causing the cancer-like behavior or the outcomes, if we really take that in, we can realize, oh my gosh, nature would not have been able to do her next step without this injury, because an injury in nature leads to her great, great invention. And so it's not until nature is stressed does biodiversification kick back in. And so adversity leads to this innovation at the genetic level. Anytime you stress an organism, it starts misspelling its genes and exuding those new possibilities outside of itself in exosomes. We call them viruses, but they're actually just packets of information of possibility. And so the global virome, or global, you know, data bank of potential new genes, is there to reimagine life after the current stress. And so when humans come along and we have this, you know, abandonment disorder, and so then we start to go in opposition, we kill everything we can find, hunt species to extinction. Once we're out of large species to hunt to extinction, we go turn our attention to the microbiome and extinct the microbiome. That's actually nature's version of a gift. Like, she's receiving that with a great sense of opportunity, and she's going to do something magnificent with that. With the last extinction, we went from dinosaurs to humans. We went from palms and ferns are the only plants on earth to deciduous trees and wildflowers. That took an extinction to get the genetic diversification to occur. And so this extinction that we're currently in is going to have a similar effect. And over the next, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions of years, the planet will be more beautiful, more intelligent, more complex than it is today. And I think that some version of humanity can persist, but a large portion of us is going to have to die. And that might be our inhumanity. We got to let our inhumanity go extinct.
Most healthcare today operates on an outdated mechanistic model, treating the body like a battlefield rather than a self-healing system. You wait months for an appointment only to receive a rushed diagnosis that labels you rather than truly understanding your unique health. Even in holistic health, many practitioners rely on endless lab tests and supplement protocols, addressing symptoms instead of the root cause. And the result? Another prescription or supplement regimen that merely suppresses or masks symptoms rather than facilitating true healing. Whether the imbalance was physical, emotional, energetic, or a mix of all three. And that's why Dr. Tom Cowan co-founded the New Biology Clinic, to offer something radically different. As one of the most respected natural health doctors in the world, Dr. Cowan has spent decades challenging conventional medicine and advancing a deeper understanding of human biology, water, and natural health. His work isn't just about rejecting the mainstream. It's about offering a more truthful, biologically coherent approach for healing. The New Biology Clinic recognizes that health isn't about fighting disease, it's about restoring balance. You're not a diagnosis, you're an individual with a unique story, and healing should honor that. With virtual consultations available worldwide, the clinic offers a flat-rate monthly membership that gives you direct access to practitioners who take the time to actually listen. Members also get exclusive health live streams, a resource library, and live sessions covering everything from biofield tuning and breathwork to movement and meditation, all designed to support whole body healing. And if you're not ready for a membership, you can book a one-time appointment, sign up for an enrichment-only membership for the healing modalities alone, or schedule a free connection session with one of the care team members to see how the New Biology Clinic can help in your specific situation. This isn't about keeping you dependent on doctors. It's about making you sovereign over your health. Head to newbiologyclinic.com and use code THEWAYFORWARD, and that's spelled the way, F-O-R-W-A-R-D, for $50 off account activation, or just head to the show notes for more info. If you're a member of The Way Forward, email hello@thewayforward.com for $150 off. Your body already knows how to heal, and New Biology Clinic helps you remember. Hey y'all, I'm here with Melissa Kupsch from Remedy Academy of Homeopathy. We are so stoked here at The Way Forward to be partnering with Melissa and Remedy in order to spread the message of homeopathy across the world, and also to partner on the eventual development of healing centers across the United States.
People are pretty quickly coming to realize that frequency is the future of medicine. we are witnessing the great resurgence of homeopathy right now. We're really moving away from that suppressive medical model. Whether it's for eczema, asthma, hormones, fertility, anxiety, depression, trauma, whatever it is, it all starts as energy in the person's field first. If we change our field, we can completely change our life. Our two-year academy is open worldwide to anyone who wants to become a homeopath. We've got 5 lecturers and we currently have over 500 students enrolled, which is record numbers in our field. A career in homeopathy is amazing for anyone who wants flexibility in their work and who wants to be valuable in creating this new world. We have stay-at-home parents enrolled. We have ex-medical professionals, grandparents signed up who want to learn how to heal their grandchildren and pass on that invaluable knowledge. We even have husband and wife teams. So my husband enrolled in the course with no prior knowledge of health as a background, and he is loving it.
Kylie is also enrolled as well. So my partner is, and she's so stoked to become a homeopath and to be helping to spread this message across the world.
The thing that we hear from so many of our students is, I found my thing. Homeopathy is the key. We harness frequencies from nature and we alter the field of all creations. So if anybody wants to join us or they want to know more about it, they can visit our website.
Yeah, and all that information will be in the show notes. So if you want to learn more about Remedy Academy, also Remedy Collective, also some of the homeopathic products that they have, please just head to the show notes. All of that will be listed there. I wonder if it's that the part of us that needs to die is our belief that we are disconnected, though, and then and getting out of that fear, guilt, shame, and even looking at fear, guilt, shame as a gift in order to lead us back to who we truly are. I've heard you talk about viruses and the virome, and you speak about it in a way that is different than the mainstream, but just... So I'm clear, what do you define as a virus?
A virus is a small packet of genetic information that's encapsulated in a couple of proteins that are able to trade that genetic information into a more complex genome. So it's basically a packet of information held in the delivery machine, but it's no more able to take over biology than anything else in nature. Similar to what we were saying, that humans don't have free will. A virus has no free will. A virus can't decide it's going to go take over another organism. A virus is always there as an opportunity or potential for gain of function for nature around it. And so it's just the imagination of the stressed nature as to what could happen if I go extinct, what could happen next. And so a virus is this packet of information. It's encapsulated in something that helps it to travel. So there's a lot of endosomes in the body, which are genetic packets of information that look just like a virus, but the envelope's not able to travel outside the body well, and it would die instantly or would be killed instantly. It's not actually living. Viruses are not living organisms, and we clump them into the microbiome too often. Viruses are not the microbiome. Viruses are the communication network of the genetics between multicellular and single-cell species. And so this is how genes swap, you know, information, or how genomes swap information across systems. So inside the body, lots of endosome communication inside cells, swapping information between the mitochondria and the human cell, for example. We now know that mitochondria, which are little tiny bacteria that live inside your cells, and there's a lot of them. Average human cell has 200 mitochondria. Any neuron in your body has about 2,000 mitochondria living in it. And they proliferate and, you know, turn over every few days, just like any bacteria. So the mitochondria are fast to transform and change, and they're constantly birthing and dying. So mitochondria in this constant state of reprocessing themselves and kind of keeping the organic guard going inside your body. And they are swapping genetic information to the nucleus of the human cell and storing many of their genes in the human DNA, which is kind of awesome to find out that bacteria can actually store their genetic information inside human DNA. We've now come to terms with the fact that the meter of DNA, each human cell has about a meter of DNA in it, which is an extremely long piece of genetic information, given that the cell is half the width of a human hair. And so it packages that meter of DNA in a very unique way, where it bundles it in basically balls of yarn kind of thing. It wraps it around those little histones, and then the histones will bundle themselves into chromosomes. And so you've got this meter of DNA, and only 1.5% of it is human genes. And so
how do we know what is human gene and what is not human gene, though, given that the reference human genome is a composite of various sources of genetic material coming from people? And ultimately, the human genome, initially in its conception, was a theorized version of what the human genome should look like. Because if you look into the extraction techniques of DNA itself, like cell lysis and using solvents and detergents, how do we know that that represents what's happening on a cellular level?
So the way in which to demonstrate that a gene is a gene is to put it in an environment where you have the apparatus for translating it to a protein. And so much of the DNA strand doesn't make proteins. And so the vast majority of it seems to be, historically it was called junk DNA. And they literally thought it was just leftover junk. And there's still a lot of literature in the science that suggests this. But in the recent years, a large group of the scientific community has come to terms with the fact that all of that DNA that doesn't produce proteins is actually producing very important information, is actually just as carefully preserved, if not more carefully preserved, than the genes themselves when we reproduce a cell or replicate. And so with that reproduction, we're saving the entire genome very carefully. And so when we only have 20,000 genes, which is the description of a DNA strand that can make a protein, and we now know because of epigenetics, each of those genes can make more like 200 different proteins at a minimum. So you can make 400,000 proteins out of just the 20,000 genes that are human. And when we call them human, you're right in that they're not unique to the human species because a pig has the same.
Well, what I mean by that is, how do we even know what the human genome actually is, given that its mapping is based on a composite of various sources of genetic material, which are ultimately based on a theorized concept of what the human genome should be?
Should be. Yeah, I mean, it's basically been a devolving model. So when we first set out in 1992 to do it, we thought we had 400,000 genes. Sequencing, and you have labs that are overlapping their data sets to find the puzzle. And so it's a cool process in a lot of ways, where you're finding all these sequences and you start doing literal puzzle making, where you're like, okay, there's one that fits that one, this one fits this one, puzzle it all together. And with that, you find out that there's a lot of information between the genes. And so you've got a lot of information that's not producing proteins that will sit between two genes. And so when the first team got done with decoding the human genome with the technology back in the 1990s, we finished around 1996, 97, and they announced that we had about 30,000 genes. Everybody laughed. They were like, that's no way, that's right. And then the second team finished, the third team finished. And as they overlapped that data, they realized they had been overcounting genes really consistently. So now we're down to count around 19,600. It seems to be the most accurate numbers currently. But I think as we keep going, we're going to find out, like, we keep overcounting these genes because of what you're saying is you're not getting the complete data set out of any single cell. And
an example, like, let me try to describe this as best I can. So say you have a library that just blew up, right? And in that library, you are certain that there's this book that exists in there that's called the Codex of Life. You're certain, 100% sure that there's this book called the Codex of Life, but you don't have any copies of it in reality, but you're certain that this library had it and this library blew up. So what you start doing is you take little fragments of sentences, little pieces of the book, little words even, and start reconstructing it based on an idea in theory of what the Codex of Life should look like. And then in addition to that, you take in other books, you take in The Great Gatsby, which we know exists, you take in The Art of War, and you say, okay, if we find any of structures that are similar to The Art of War or similar to The Great Gatsby, we know for sure that that's not going to be in the Codex of Life. What I'm getting at is, unless you have a clear picture of what the human genome is first, how can you know what is and is not a part of the human genome? Because the whole point is the human genome itself is a theorized model.
It's a theoretical model until you operationalize it. And so when you can take a strand of nucleotides and turn it into a strand of amino acids that then self-fold into a protein that has function, that's how you determine you definitely have a gene. To your point, though, there is no book. And that's the frustrating thing that we've come to realize in recent years is the library blew up, or you have to blow up the library to get down to the letters, basically. That's what you do with a cell to go get the DNA
out. Cell lysis itself. Like, if you were to do cell lysis to you at the same volume, would you look like Zach Bush?
I would, in the water.
But you would be ground up version of Zach Bush, essentially.
But not in the water. It's the interesting thing is who's organizing the words. It's not. So this is where it comes down to this interesting thing is there's no book. We used to think that human DNA made humans. We now realize, no, the DNA strand in our body is hardly anything that we could call human. The DNA that sits inside any nucleus, whether it be inside of a mitochondria or inside of a human nucleus or inside an earthworm, inside a flower, whatever it is, that genetic information is basically a hardware store. It hasn't written a book and it hasn't built a house. There is no book and there is no house. It's a hardware store that gives you lots of potential opportunities. But the fact is that until that book is, or until that hardware store is put into motion by a blueprint of what it wants to build, it doesn't know what to do.
Where does that blueprint come from, though?
It's not in the cell. And so the blueprint for life is held in something permanent. And that permanent thing can't get blown up. And this is really where we were earlier, is it doesn't matter if you're looking into the eyes of a child who hasn't been born out of that sack yet, or you're sitting there holding the hand of a person who's dying and going back and forth across the veil to go travel outside the body to some far off planet and then come back and tell you about it. At no point is that individual lost the blueprint or lost the identity. And so the way that I would state this, that every single being, whether it be an oak tree or a human, every single being is a expression of a permanent identity, and that permanent identity is able to express itself in many, many different ways, probably simultaneously. And so whatever my template is, it's unique to yours, because I've never quantum entangled with you in the sense that I can't wake up in the morning being you and knowing you. I can have a lot of interesting experiences with you. I can have lots of experiences, and you know, this is where marriage is so interesting. You keep waking up next to the same person. There is, at the atomic level, quantum entanglement of the biology and the particles, but at no point do the identities actually entangle. And so that's the permanence that I'm talking about. Your body can actually start to express your partner's DNA. Over time, you guys will actually start to look more like each other.
I was just thinking that in my mind, because before we started recording, I think I was talking about how, like, a lot of what we ascribe physicality to could be explained at a metaphysical level. I mean, this is an interesting, like, thing to consider, that modern science says we are only able to perceive 0.0035% of the available electromagnetic spectrum. The thing that people don't question in that statement is, how did modern science determine what is the available electromagnetic spectrum? So that's only what, with our human instrumentation, we have come to conceive that this is the limited, or this is the available electromagnetic spectrum, and we can only perceive 0.0035% of it. But how do we even know what that spectrum is? It could be far beyond that, and we can see even less than we think we can perceive. My point is that there's so much happening around us metaphysically, and the scientific community, by and large, is obsessed with looking at physical determinants for what happens in this reality. So I really appreciate that you said that, that I think that's what you're alluding to, is that there is something beyond our either capacity to understand, something beyond our capacity to measure, something that is metaphysical, that is ultimately the driving force for how we organize our biology and how life itself organizes.
I think we can perceive 100% of reality, just not with our eyes. Yeah. And so, yes, we can see 0.something of something. And you're exactly right. And we do this all the time. When I grew up, I was told, you know, that there's probably billions of, you know, suns out there. You know, by the time I 1990s rolls around, we've got the Hubble telescope, you know, giving us data back. And now suddenly scientists are saying, oh my gosh, we have like probably 2.5 billion galaxies out there, each one with probably 5 billion suns in each one. And they're like, whoa, everybody's blowing their mind. And then just like 2 years ago, we got, you know, James Webb telescope launched, get a whole new look at the cosmos. And like, oh, shoot, we were actually quite off. We've been calculating all of this stuff for the last 20 years on a number that was the possibility of 2.5 billion galaxies. It looks like it's actually 2.5 trillion. So we were off by 1,000-fold with our current instrumentation, you know? And so it's just this hilarious thing that we keep defining the limits of anything. You can't. You cannot find the limits of anything that you cannot measure. And so we continue to believe that what we see is what's real.
Right.
And this is profoundly limiting, whether you're looking at the human DNA or the cosmos itself. You're getting a semblance of reality. And there's a scripture that I love that's one of the best lines, and it's translated into English so well because it gives me goosebumps every time I think of it. But the King James Bible has this verse in it that says, humans, we see through the glass darkly. And what that seems to be referenced to when you piece out what the Greek was using when it got translated into that. The glass darkly is a description of stained glass and the experience of that. And so if you've been in a church or someplace with stained glass, you get a sense that the light comes through. And if somebody were to walk right on the other side of that, you'd get a sense that there was a shadow that passed by it. But you would certainly not be able to see their face or anything else. And that's pretty much what we're doing to reality. And so we're looking through the glass darkly. And because of our fear that we're separate from everything, we've been rejected, we have such an intense desire out of fear to know everything we can and to define it quickly and then reassure each other that we know what's going on.
Yeah.
Because we're afraid of not knowing.
Agree.
And so it's that little thing. And then when you suddenly realize I'm not kicked out of nature, I am nature, then you get to get out of your five senses. And the body is equipped with 12 at least. So there's seven other senses deep in your core that are often referred to as chakra centers or energy centers. And those spaces create physical sensation in your body that are very easy to tune into. And this is how the children are reading cards blindfolded. They're not seeing it with their eyes. They're sensing it with their aura, their energy field.
Yep.
And so their energy field has seven different centers that can feel seven different, you know, elements or perspectives on the cosmos. And so if you put a child before age five into an environment where it's allowed to feel the all 12 senses, it can sense the entire reality around it. And I really want people to know this, because there can be a sense of our previous conversation that can be defeating, of like, well, if scientists don't know anything, then how would I know anything?
And that's not the way I mean it, by the way.
No, I know that. Yeah. But and I don't feel that from you at all. Yeah. I can feel your optimism in it. But I think this is the take home, is the reason why us as scientists have been telling you all of the wrong things is because we were using these limited five senses that were trying to describe a whole that it could not see. And it had straightened itself out of the belief that it was the universe. When you come to the terms of the fact that you are the universe expressed through a fractal of the universe that has to have the whole hologram of the universe in it, because you are, you know, this fractal of a creative force, and you've now expressed a human body that is resonating inside of column water that can feel everything. Now you can have wisdom within you. You can tap into wisdom within you that no scientist will ever see under a microscope. And so children today, just like children always, are completely tied in to this all-knowingness. This is why a three-year-old will suddenly speak up in the back of the seat on a road trip and say something that just gives everybody goosebumps. Is they were spaced out looking out the window, and nobody was talking to that child for long enough that the child could have an original feeling. And they will tell you something magnificent. And every time I heard my kids say that, and, you know, I just felt like I was feeling the divine. I was feeling some source talking to me. And I have sadness inside of me that I wasn't awake enough as a human at that point in my life to stop there and then consider what's the current conditions that allowed that child to have that experience and say that thing. If I had done that, I would have consistently found out that it's very sad how little time a child has to be connected to their whole feelingness, because we are distracting them so much by the visible world, the sense world. And I have a deep heartache that my children are now going to spend the rest of their life trying to refine their whole knowingness that I had trained them out of by putting them in an environment where it was so infrequent that they could tap into that. It might be once a week. They could have been in that space 100% of the time if I hadn't described them to a world of distraction and ultimately of addiction and trained them into the abandonment disorder so that they'd have to be addicted to something. And, you know, I definitely demonstrated to them addiction to productivity and work. I was relentless. And it's not until recently that they're starting to get a glimpse of what it looks like when I hold still for a moment. And that's a tragedy in my parenting, you know, and I'm heartbroken that that's a pattern that's played out over thousands of generations now. We have divorced ourselves from the all-knowingness, and in our fear of feeling that disconnectedness, then we go and try to define everything, try to make up the book from the blown-up library or whatever it is, and then we go run around for decades telling each other, this is how it is, this is how it is, despite the fact that there's every year more mounting evidence that that's definitely not how it is. And so finally, there's so much cognitive dissonance to a system that it collapses. And so fortunately, we do collapse our systems of philosophy and science and all of this quite frequently through time, right? We are at this moment now where I think there's enough collapse in the scientific community. There's so much incoherent data. There's so much dissonance in the thought process of the current model of physics, let alone biology, that is shattering. Mm. And what we're finding is so many children and young adults and, you know, women at every age that are now feeling the whole reality, that they're demanding change. And the scientific community has been slow to wake up to it. I was slow to wake up to it. And so it took me decades of being in the medical community before I finally surrendered my clinic, closed my clinic a couple years ago, finding out that every single person that I came in touch with that I was calling a patient needed to instead be a collaborator. And so close the clinic. We can't have any more doctors, patients. We can't have that paradigm if we're going to really move people forward. And so everybody's now a collaborator. And so we built the Journey of Intrinsic Health with the message that everybody has its own intrinsic health that nobody can improve on. Mm. You knit yourself together in your mother's womb by a design that I or no other scientist can even begin to conceive of the model, let alone the glory of what's going on in that process. How did your soul know how to design you to be the vessel that would vibrate in the exact frequencies that you vibrate in to embody a character, a personality, a persona, an identity that is permanent? How do you knit something together to create a finite, temporary moment of something that's infinite? That is so miraculous to think about. This body is my soul's way of expressing itself in a moment. What's the beginning of time? Again, we constantly change that number. Universe is 10 billion years old. Well, actually, no, we messed that up. It's 15 billion years old. Up by 30% every single time you correct. Like, it's not like slightly off. You're just way off. And so we don't know the beginning of time, but we can feel the beginning of time. And I've gotten to this joyful point in my life where happened so powerfully this weekend. I wish I could tell you what happened this weekend, but I haven't had time to integrate it, figure it out. But something happened with two dear friends that are brand new in my life. Just met them a few days ago. There was a stillness that occurred between the three of us that allowed ancestors to come in the room and teach us. And his mother in particular, who he was resuscitating when she died of a heart attack on a hike. They went on a journey together in her death cycle that I believe really moved humanity forward. There's a deep wound that we talk about in religious circles and in the psyche. It's just a story. It's not really a wound, but there's a deep disconnect at our cellular level in what we call the masculine, which is part of each of us. So we both have balance masculine and feminine qualities within us. There's an injury there that can only be healed by the mother. And so it's this mother-son relationship that has been pointed to for eons as the pathway to our survival. Isis and Horus, Mary and Christ, these archetypes kept occurring through history, that it wasn't mother-father, it was mother-son. There needs to be a reconciliation of the human DNA on the masculine side through the mother. And this weekend, suddenly this mother came into the room with us and laid out in my perception. Again, there's no human words to contain it, because it wasn't perceived in my mind. It was, if you had to put a sense on it, it would be more visual than heard. It would be more of this, but she demonstrated to my other seven senses what this original wound is and how the mother-son relationship can heal that, and how we move towards that. And so while I can't tell you in words what it is, I can pass on to all of you that it does not take any effort to remember the original design of the masculine. Mm. It's something that is inherent in every single one of you, male, female, man, woman, it doesn't matter. Every single one of you has a complete map of it, and it resides in the water. And Luc Montagnier, and my colleague that I mentioned earlier, Luc, I think he wrote the paper that he should have been given the Nobel Prize for in 2010.
DNA transference?
DNA waves and water. DNA waves and water. And that paper, you know, really deserves an enormous amount of attention, because it's showing us that water can express nucleotide sequences. And so this is suggesting that the book is not written by the DNA strand. Instead, the book is written by the water. And if you read scripture, you know, any one of them, you will find out that the water is at the beginning. And so in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And in the beginning, the firmament was covered in water. And then reality started to set in. And so out of the water came everything. And we now know that we could propagate DNA all over the cosmos. And so we could propagate humans and any other, you know, biodiversity that we have here by simply laser projecting genetic information through light waves, and any planet that has water on it will start to build nucleotide sequences. I believe this is how we got here, is that light energy carried the possibility of life in it. And when it hit a planet that was water, DNA started to form, and the first molds came along to start to concentrate energy on the planet's surface so that it could coordinate more life. Life is ultimately the concentration of light energy. You can't get life without a many-fold increase in light energy over a sun. Suns don't produce life. You have to take that solar energy and concentrate it to maybe 1,000 times higher than the sun can produce. So 1,000-fold brighter than nuclear energy comes the capacity for life. And so we are in this miraculous dance between light, water, and carbon. And those are the elements that nature has decided to spell out its physical form in. And around my neck is Solomon's shield here. And that shape, it's an iteration of what people would think of as the Muslim star or the Star of David from the Jewish traditions. But that star has been showing up in sacred geometry since the beginning of human expression. And it turns out what it shows is interlacing triangles. And so it's not overlapping, it's actually interlaced. And that interlaced one, so that's the difference between Solomon's shield depiction of it and something like the Jewish star. That interlaced triangles that is Solomon's shield is the exact formation of the six protons and the six neutrons of carbon. And so I just find it very fascinating that the sacred geometries that have been distilled down to what is the face of God, what is the protection of God, what is the way in which you interact with God, is the carbon molecule at its atomic structure. And I get really kind of goosebumped out over the fact that we have built a bunch of human stories to try to capture the glory of a universe that works. And out of that came a lot of religions. And in our fear of nature being divorced from it, we started to fear one another, and we created a war over those religions. But every single religion is simply pointing us back at the fabric of the beauty of everything, and is going to keep pointing you back to water and carbon over and over again. And there's an opportunity for us to relax now and realize, yes, there is a deep human wound. And I carry that. It's something about this destruction of nature, this abandonment of this nature, this disconnect from source. And that may be relatively recent in our history, because we seem to have participated in building some magnificent technologies that we now don't know how to build. The pyramids would be a good example of that.
Or just look at any Capitol building. Like, look at the Capitol building in Texas, for example. I mean, that's a whole nother rabbit hole. But the point is, like, that strikes a sense of awe and wonder in you, because you know that that is our true ability. That is our true creative capacity.
Yeah. Yeah, go stand in the, my dad was, and all of his siblings were at St. Albans growing up, and that's a school that's taught in the National Cathedral. So imagine your schooling being in the vaulted ceilings of the National Cathedral. And so I'm always so envious of his journey, because I was like in these hippie schools in Colorado, but
those are pretty cool too.
They had their own groove to them. Yeah. The Rocky Mountains were a pretty good backdrop to my imagination, but when I go into those halls, they have these tunnels in the walls of the cathedral that go vertical, and they have these tiny little ladders that go up these tunnels that are built inside the walls. And so inside the walls, these little laddered tunnels, and they send these little boys, 5, 6, 7 years old, into these little tunnels because I couldn't fit in. These little boys go in and they climb into the ceiling where there's a little alcove that's an opening for them to sing down into the cathedral from. And so my dad grew up climbing those ladders to sing down into the National Cathedral with his little boy voice. That just makes me cry every time that we did that. Like, some architect was like, what if we put the kids up in the ceiling to sing to us? Like, what would that sound like? Like, that's so magnificent.
So incredible.
That some adult, you know, in their most magical silence suddenly realized, we have angels among us. They are our children. Let's let them sing to us and let the heavens open when we set them up in the ceilings of this cathedral. And so we did that. And now you walk into any building in Austin here or anywhere else in the world.
And it's just, I mean, like, this is a perfect example of it, honestly.
Dead. Dead structures, square, 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 yeah. No flow, no movement, no life. And so it's just fascinating to me that, like you say, in 100 years, we forgot.
Yeah.
We have forgotten that nature is everywhere and everything is expressing life if we let it. And when we stop building our entire systems on productivity, convenience, and comfort, and we start to wonder about what would it feel like to feel Earth again? Well, I would have to get out of the air conditioning. I'd have to like go actually feel the sun on my back. I'd have to bend over and put my feet in a garden and then smell the earth when I pull a weed in gratitude for what it's contributed to the soils, and smell that earth and ask it to now nourish my plants as I use that weed as the top treatment that I'll mulch my tomato plants with, you know. And so everything is there to create more abundance and give back. And death is always the optimal gift. There's nothing that gives back to life like a death. An oak tree, when it dies, oaks have very small genomes, a few dozen genes. The cool thing about an oak tree is it never wakes up wondering if it was a good oak tree yesterday. It just was a good oak tree yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so there's this simplicity about nature that nothing doubts anything until it becomes human. Mm-hmm. You know, and so humans are the only place where we've developed this ability for doubt. So the oak tree is no doubt of its identity. And for 100 years, it grows and thrives. And then suddenly, you know, the core gets old enough or a lightning bolt comes along. That thing falls on the core, and those 36 genes or so of the oak tree, when sequenced in 1 year, has 100,000 species that have now taken over that oak tree and are creating life out of that one tree. And so death over and over again produces a volume and a biodiversity of life that we really can't even metric, because you cannot kill or create energy. You can only change its form. And so death is just this massive opportunity for reinvention, recreation. And that's the cycle we're in right now. So the earth is in a very predictable 20,000-year desertification cycle that's almost towards its end. And so we're almost complete with a death cycle of the earth. And it will rebirth now. And it's starting to do that. And so my nonprofit Project Biome is trying to bring awareness to governments and industries and NGOs worldwide that Africa is ready to rebirth. And when the Sahara Desert goes green again, 1/3 of the planet goes green again. And when that happens, the amount of energy potential on the planet goes bonkers. And so we're going to have more energy on the surface of the Earth in the form of green plants and biodiversity than ever in its history over the next couple hundred years. And if we participate, we can actually accelerate that, because we now know as humans, with the industry that nature can do through us, we can actually accelerate these cycles of carbon and water. And so the whole of humanity needs to revalue all of our systems within carbon and water metrics. Carbon is not the demon. This whole carbon sequestration and CO2's poisoning the atmosphere, it could not be a bigger misperception of science than that. That CO2 is the breath of the Earth about to be taken. We have killed her lungs through all of the chemical farming. 97% of the arable farmable soils on the Earth are now depleted or severely depleted of the microbiome for carbon cycling. And so with 97% of our soils gone, we can't breathe. And so we've developed emphysema. When you lose all of your lung tissue, you can't breathe. CO2 goes up in your bloodstream. CO2 is going up in the atmosphere, not because it's a problem, but because it's the symptom of a loss of lung tissue. In a single season, from fall to spring, our farm fields that we're witnessing going into this regen process of stop plowing, stop spraying the chemicals, and let nature do its thing with some biodiversity, help it out with a cover crop, and then let it rest. By that next spring, the weeds are gone. The soil is doing something it hasn't done in over 80 years. You see soil returning, carbon cycling, life returning, earthworms are back. You give it a little bit of protection. You cover that soil all season long instead of leaving it bare between the rows of corn or whatever. Keep that soil covered. Keep it armored from the elements. And by the following year, you can't believe what's happened to that land, its verdant potential and everything else. The grace of nature, the speed at which she wants to come back and force us into a biologic frequency that we've never been in, is always there. The Earth is always advancing to higher levels of energy, ascension of intelligence through its genetics, through its energetics. And this is why the planet is so sought after, is we have the ability, because we have the right balance of carbon and oxygen here, to do the dance of God, to create so much here. And it's happening in every uterus in the world that has the blessing of a pregnancy. It happens in every human that has the ability to come to stillness for a moment and let nature create through it. And suddenly you've got lyrics to your new song. The poem is now on your journal page. The new company is now being formed that you've been wanting to do all the time, and you just got the big breakthrough. Nature is expressing us through us so potently. And right now, at this time, we are the most biodiverse and therefore most intelligent species on the planet. And for that, we should be in a sense of awe for one another. And it is time for us to go into radical amnesty. This is the decade that we must come to a fruition of a global forgiveness. And it has to begin there at the apology and the forgiveness that will follow it. And if we don't begin there, we will not survive. Our current infertility rates are reaching 70% in a lot of countries now. With 70% of our children unable to birth children, we disappear very quickly as a species. In the United States, anytime you dip below a birth rate of 2.1, you're on an extinction path. Every 10th below 1.61, you accelerate by another decade or generation, the rate at which that's going to disappear. Currently, the United States just published ours again a couple weeks ago, and we're at 1.61. The United States is on an extinction path. Japan and China are way ahead of us. Japan is going extinct actively. There's some estimates that we could have 30 million empty residences in just the city of Tokyo alone by 2030. The country is aging out. They have not been able to reproduce. China had the one-child policy for just long enough to find out that they had sterilized their own people in that same couple decades of the policy. So when they suddenly realized they were going to lose their population, and they said, oh, everybody should go have babies, nobody could have babies. There's no fertility left in the country because of the poisons that were imported into that country. All of the microplastics that it imported, all of the chemicals that it deployed. They make more glyphosate in China than anywhere else in the world.
Really?
And so we've so poisoned that country that they will not be able to recover genetically. I'm spending a lot of time in the Middle East right now. The infertility rate's reaching 68% in just the women alone. Men in all of these countries, our sperm counts are just plummeting all over the world. So we've played out the human journey now. There's enough genetic injury at the epigenetic level that we will go extinct on our current path. And we're not genetic creatures. We're energetic. We are permanent creatures of God. We are permanent fractals and identities of God. And so we only have one way out now, which is we're going to have to remember the original design. And it's not writ in the book of the DNA. That is not a book. It is a hardware store. The book of who you are is held at the promise of you as an identity that's been here and loved since the beginning of time. And so if you will settle down and go still, and like the child who can read cards with its eyes covered, you will start to see your real self. And from that resonance, you will find in your water the original design of the human that was meant to be there as an expression, as a finite expression that would live, die in the name and in the identity of your permanent identity. That thing is here, and it is remembered in your water. And you can rewrite the genetics of humanity. And so what we have to do is begin with the, I am so sorry that I forgot myself. I'm so sorry that I believed everybody else other than myself. I'm so sorry that I spent so many decades unlearning myself. I'm so sorry that I bought into the story that I'm not enough, that I'm somehow separate from nature, that I'm somehow never going to be able to be loved or love enough. I'm so sorry. And that's the beginning with yourself. If you can really deeply, honestly, sincerely apologize to yourself for the ignorance that you've bred into yourself and maybe your children, and then begin the apology or follow the apology with that forgiveness of like, oh my gosh, like, of course I would have done that because I started to be trained in a new human brain, which can't even see like a fraction of 0.003%. I had to come to those conclusions because I had been given a data set that was so limited. And so I forgive myself because it was actually a super simple problem. And I can see a super simple way out of that now is just listening and remembering. And if I listen and remember enough, the whole human story goes away in a poof. And so within one fall and a good winter of rest, next spring, we could see a new humanity that has no memory of the chemical trauma of our herbicides, pesticides, antibiotic era. We could have no memory of the psychological stress and that we played out on our children or our parents played out on us because we began again, because we wrote the story not back to when we were two, not back to our great-grandparents and their trauma in World War II. We rewrote the story to the beginning of the water on the planet that remembers the original design. Water has perfect memory, and in you is a pattern that will be empowered by your awareness. The awareness of an entity that has been here from the beginning of time, paying attention to its original design within water that makes its particle expression possible, is an indelible trait and capacity that you have. You are always real. You have always been real, and now listen into your water and be witness to the beauty that your design inherently has within it, and then rebuild. And in that rebuilding, sweep that forgiveness across a society that is ready for it. We can travel at the speed of forgiveness this fall, and next spring, know a different humanity that would be part of the emergence of the new planet that is ready to birth. This is all going to happen. This isn't theoretical. This has happened so many times in so many dances of the cosmos. And whatever story I'm telling now is the 0.003% of the real beauty. But you can feel what I can't tell you. Inside of each of you right now, go quiet and feel your original design. I trust that more than I trust any other story I've ever heard or told.
That was so well said. So beautiful. My goodness.
What if nature's intelligence could directly influence your physiology, helping to regulate your nervous system, sharpen your intuition, and shift your emotional state in a measurable way? For over 25 years, Lotus Way has been pioneering the use of flower essences, liquid infusions that capture the bioenergetic imprint of plants. Unlike essential oils, these remedies work on a vibrational level, interacting with your body's meridians and electrical system to promote clarity, resilience, and balance. Katie Hess, who I featured on episode 74 of the Way Forward podcast, has spent decades studying the effects of over 300 rare and powerful flowers, hand collecting them from across the world. The result? A line of elixirs, mists, and anointing oils, and even some chocolate, designed to shift your state of mind and body. Not through placebo, but through the subtle yet profound ways plant frequencies interact with human biology. I think flower essences are severely overlooked in the wellness space because it really is an incredible way to package up the wisdom and the innate intelligence of nature and deliver it to your body. And it brings your body back into coherence because it's tuning you on an energetic level like an instrument. So if you want to find which flower essences are right for you, you can take the flower quiz so you can see which ones match your current energetic state. As a listener of The Way Forward, you get an exclusive discount. Just use code ALEC10 for 10% off your first order. Or if you're the Way Forward member, get 20% off plus ongoing savings, and just reach out to us if you're a member and we'll get you your membership discount. Just go to lotusway.com/ALEC or just head to the show notes so you can experience one of nature's most powerful energetic remedies today.
Yeah, there are so many other things that I wanted to get into, but I don't even think it's fitting. I think this is a good stopping point. And man, there's so many bits in there that were just such potent medicine, even for me in my own life. Like going back to what you said about your son on long road trips looking out the car window. I literally have a notes section on my phone of stuff that my son has said when sitting on long road trips looking out the window. And that's why I started to cry when you brought that up, because it's like, thank you for that important reminder of like, we're inundating them with so many man-made distractions, which aren't all bad, and it's not necessarily, you know, like all that they're destructive, but how much are you cultivating an experience of them sitting with that presence? And the common thread in looking out the window is that they're not doing anything else except for observing nature. And how often are we cultivating that? Because that's how we remember. That's how we get this immediate download, if you want to call it that, of information from God, and then are exclaiming it in the middle of a car ride while we're playing music and my wife's hungry and the, you know, my daughter's screaming about something, but then my son says something just so incredibly profound, and it's like, you know, deep down behind the words that is coming from a pure source, unadulterated by the human conditioning. It's coming directly from God. And like, how often can we cultivate that? The more that we can cultivate that, the more that we get back to who and what we truly are, and the more this comes back to a sense of healing and a sense of harmony.
It's exactly well said. And, you know, for all of us at every age, Khalil Gibran gave us the perfect marching orders 100 years ago. He was asked, how should we parent? And he said, oh, it's very easy to parent. Every day you wake up and you strive to think more like your children, and you make sure you never tell them to think like you. And so it's time for all of us to return to our childlike instincts and start to go out in nature so that we can tap into that genius. Yeah. It can happen at any age. And certainly there's an incredible return to the womb that happens at death. And our elders are on their way back to that childhood. And so the two people that you will trust with that unadulterated wisdom will be a 3-year-old and an 80-year-old. They will tell you what the truth is outside of the human consciousness, because they are merging back towards that veil again. And we are not listening to our elders. And so listen to your children in the back seat, and then drive to your great-grandmother's house and make sure those children are sitting, because the communion between a grandchild and their great-grandparent is one that will bridge the wound. And it will be that mother to son, you know, kind of pattern of can the elder commune with the younger long enough that the younger is able to remember what happened and where the truth lies, you know. And so we will not survive as an American public because we have broken our generational relationship so deeply by, you know, banking our children in schools and warehousing our elders in nursing homes. It breaks the entire cycle of wisdom. And so our species is doomed if we continue this pattern of behavior of separation of this of the generations. The Blue Zones have proved it over and over again. There's no similar food, no similar environment. It's all about multi-generational living. And so any community that knows where it comes from and knows its ancestral patterns and sits long enough to learn from each other will live long. And so it's not that the Blue Zones had anything particular with their location. It was a culture of connectedness that came along in each of those people groups to nurture life into its fullest potential. And this, again, is my concern about biohacking, is I think it creates extreme isolation. Any time that you start to understand your life through a three-dimensional reductionist data set, you've lost the God inside of you. And you are now so separated by your information stream that, and now you wake up and instead of writing down your dreams, you immediately jump on your app to see how many hours of REM sleep you got. God is being stolen from you right now by the technologies you're wearing. Shed those technologies for a while. Listen in. You know if you had a good night's sleep or not. You don't need something to tell you this. You know if you had a bad night of sleep, and you know exactly why you had a bad night of sleep if you will listen to your own body. In a week, you can know which lifestyle would produce the maximum amount of dream state possible, which is important because your dreams are the only place you experience no doubt. And so we need to reverse the paradigm. We need to dream new dreams and be confident in that sensation that each of us are capable of in those dreams of living without doubt. It's the highest frequency we can express. There was an interesting study done recently. I know we were supposed to be done a minute ago, but this is a good maybe point to finish with, is that they went in with the premise, and that's always dangerous when scientists have premise to begin with, but that's why we actually always study the null hypothesis, because the hypothesis is dangerous. You can't actually effectively study the hypothesis because you screw it up every time with bias. And so you have to actually study the null hypothesis, which means the opposite of what you think. And so first you write your hypothesis down. I think that this causes this. And then you have to say, well, what if it's the opposite of this? And then you have to go explore that. That's the best we can do with these biased minds at trying to erase that bias. It's not perfect, but it does get you a lot further down the road. And it's frustrating as a scientist to do it, because when you write your null hypothesis, it looks ridiculous on paper. And then the experiment gets very interesting as you go out to prove that or study that factor. But the hypothesis was that the highest vibrational frequencies that a human body can generate is when it feels love or joy. So they put humans in a Faraday cage to create a perfect isolated electromagnetic field, and then would have the person engage the person in an interview with story. And so they'd tell stories about their grandmother or the things. And sure enough, they found these huge bursts of energy coming out of the being when it would go into stories of love and joy and gratitude and all of the predictable things. But they would also take them into anger and frustration and hopelessness and depression and go through all of those things and frequencies. And there was this annoying finding that kept happening, that 40 times higher frequency than love and joy, a burst would come. And it was very inconsistent, seemingly, as to the emotional state of the person. They could be expressing anger and this thing would happen. And it wasn't, there's clearly the anger frequency. And then there would be this 40X thing. They could be expressing love and then be almost done with the love story and then express this really high frequency discharge. As they listened back through over and over again, they realized that it was at those same points they were getting goosebumps with the person's story. And so somebody in there came up with the theory of, I wonder if it's an authentic moment that we're sensing. So they redid the experiment, and sure enough, authenticity is 40 times higher generator than love and joy. Your soul doesn't have emotions. Your soul is authentic. The you that you really want to connect with is not a state of an emotional feeling. It's not a state of being. It is an authentic version of you. It is the authentic experience of seeing the beauty of you. And when you see how beautiful you are, you will go into a deep sense of grief because you've been so disconnected from that for so long. You will go into a deep sense of joy for feeling the reverence inside of you. You'll go into a deep state of love for the beauty that you can see in yourself. But you won't find it until you start to value the authentic version of you, the authentic reality of you. You are an authentic being, and it is unchangeable by your philosophy, your schisms, your religion, your spirituality, whatever it is imperturbed. And so find that truth and you will live a life where everything you say will give everybody goosebumps, because you're starting to speak from source. You're starting to speak like a child again. So find that authentic chord and you can live a very beautiful long life, and you can shed the biohacking hopes and simply live a long, happy life.
Boom. Zach, thank you so much for joining me, man.
Honored to be with you.